Thanks again, that's wonderful, thank you. I considered a single New Year's resolution for 2008 and then quickly set it aside. As you heard me tell the children earlier, I tend to shy away from making them, so why start now? Especially since the resolution that kind of flew through my head was to not mention any work by Jack Kerouac for a whole year. Which probably would have played pretty well, but only to realize, as I said, that I was planning on using a passage from his work for my first sermon of 2008, so it would have been down the chute right from the beginning. As I say, that's why I don't make resolutions, because sometimes they fence me in, as this one would have. So to begin. In the concluding paragraph of the novel On the Road, Mr. Kerouac offers a poetic ode, although written in prose form, to the America that he's been traveling back and forth across for 3 to 4 years prior to his writing the first draft of his novel. And he very romantically writes about the evening star shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, and blessing the rivers and cupping the mountain peaks and folding the final shore in, and all of this Walt Whitman-esque type of language. But then, when he gets near the end of that very final paragraph, he throws in a line that seems to throw it all off when he writes, "And nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody but the forlorn rags of growing old." It's a little jarring. One moment, we're sailing along over prairies and rivers and mountain peaks and shores, only to suddenly get whacked up by the head, by the forlorn rags of growing old. And Kerouac's central character of the book gets something of the same treatment. Excuse me. Throughout the text, we get Dean Moriarty, patterned after the real-life person of Neil Cassidy. Dean Moriarty, a very wild, exasperating, untamed, very often hugely irresponsible, free spirit, who opens up the shy and introspective Sal Paradise, who's Kerouac's persona, to what Sal calls joy, kicks, and darkness. But the last we see of Dean in the book, he's standing alone on a New York City street corner, wearing what Kerouac describes as a ragged, moth-eaten overcoat, while Sal Paradise and the new woman in his life and another couple ride off in a limo to a concert. The forlorn rags of growing old, Dean alone in a ragged, moth-eaten overcoat. This is where Kerouac's road in this book actually ends. And that is why it baffles me to this day how critics of this book, who ridiculed and dismissed it as little more than a tribute to mindless hedonism and an attempt to seduce an entire generation into the depths of depravity and amorality, that was Norman Podhoretz's take on it anyway, couldn't really see where the author was going with it. For he was trying to show both the overlay and the underlay of the road. And by extension, the overlay and the underlay of the life journeys that we're all on. The overlay is that of joy and hope and exuberance and craziness and believing that what you are searching for and reaching for is somewhere out there somewhere, if you can just get at it and track it down. Somewhere along the way, I would find the pearl, as Kerouac's Sal Paradise puts it. Pearl that's out there somewhere. But I say there's also an underlay in this book of tragedy and loss and sadness, of the road and life slipping by with nothing but the spectra of meaninglessness at the end, being alone in the ragged, moth-eaten overcoat, the forlorn rags of growing old. At age 29, which was Kerouac's age when he wrote this novel, this is what I think was the genius of his writing, he was able to see at that early age both of those sides of the road. And the tragic irony of his life is that he himself succumbed to the road's shadow side once the demons of success and celebrity finally came his way. The forlorn rags of growing old caught up to him when he was only 47 years old. Okay, having broken the New Year's resolution I didn't make, what does any of this have to do with tracking the seasons of one's life? Well, let me offer this personal reflection. One of the ways I have tracked my own life journey and road has been to read On the Road at different times in my life. And I find that my experience in doing this, when I share my thoughts with others who do the same thing, we find we come out in very similar kinds of places. Because if you read this book in your 20s, you're going to key into the enthusiasm, you're going to key into the wildness, you're going to key into the craziness, you key into the hope and the promise of finding your pearl somewhere along the way, and you just want to get out there and go for it. If you're in your 20s, that's what you got to do. When you read a book like this, you have to find your pearl. And I found then that to go back to the very same text at different stages in one's life is to key into that sobering underlay that's in the novel as well. It's to finally hear the questions the character of Carlo Marx, who's patterned in the book after Allen Ginsberg, finally confronts the book's madcap protagonist with when he asks them, "What is the meaning of this voyage? I mean, man, whither goest thou in thy shiny new car?" Well, I find I'm still attracted, I'm still excited in a certain kind of way to the wild and crazy side of On the Road whenever I read it. I did a thing down in Lowell last summer in conjunction with the Kerouac exhibit there, where a local cable station videotaped people reading different parts of it at different times. When I was asked what part I wanted to read, I deliberately chose the section of the book, if you've read it, you know about it, where Sal and Dean make this just crazy head-on ride from Denver to Chicago along the back roads of the country where there were no interstates. That part of the book is still my favorite part. But what I've also come to see, as I periodically revisit this text, is that part of the life, road, and journey is the acceptance of loss. The acceptance that tragedy is as much a part of the life journey as is joy. And I discovered that a deliberative and dedicated pursuit of one's pearl, knowing that there will be setbacks and disappointments in that pursuit, I discovered that that in the end is more rewarding than a kind of madcap dashing after that pearl, even though, as I say, there's a time in your life when you got to do that. I think on these things. It's another year. 2008, this time around, comes upon us. It's just another day in the calendar, in the way, in the midst of a rather cold and snowy winter. But we human beings are the creatures on this planet who mark the passing of time. In fact, I think one of the peculiarities of our species is that we are uniquely aware of the passing of time, and we count years, days, months, as a way of doing that. Several years ago, one of my friends and colleagues in the UU ministry, the Reverend Chuck Gaines, who is now long into retirement down in Arizona, lived in New England all his life, finally decided, I guess, he had to get away from these kinds of things. He wrote a little Christmas meditation, which, while done in a radically different style from On the Road, offers a similar message to the one I've been sharing. And as I read it over, I realized it works equally well as a New Year's meditation. Chuck wrote, "I have lived more than half the Christmases I shall ever see, and I know I won't get everything I want or have hoped for." And then the three wants or the hopes, his pearl, if you will, that he writes about in this little meditation are first our immortality, being able to control life, as he puts it, so I never feel sad or hurt or afraid. And third, peace on earth and a world where hunger, poverty, racism, and ignorance would be eliminated. When I'm on one level, it's probably a little irrational to want or expect such things. But Chuck is writing in some ways, a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek, but he's also writing on another level because he realizes that these are very widespread, universal human yearnings. They are, in a sense, the pearl that we all hope is out there somewhere or within our lives. But let's take those three things one at a time. As I say, Chuck is being deliberately tongue-in-cheek in some of these places, particularly when he says he wanted immortality. We all know, usually before our age even hits double digits, that we're not going to be around forever. But there is a time in one's life. There is a time when you do feel that you have all the time you need to accomplish everything you want to accomplish, which is a kind of de facto immortality. And that's a wonderful time of life, and it really should be lived out with that kind of awareness, that kind of thinking. But as the seasons of our lives move along, we find that part of the growth process comes in casting off some of our long-held hopes and expectations, and to do that in ways that actually makes the life journey a little lighter, maybe even a little more meaningful. This is the theme, in fact, of a very fine book written many years ago by Judith Viorst. It's called Necessary Losses. Its subtitle is, I love this one, The Loves, Illusions, Dependencies, and Impossible Expectations That All of Us Have to Give Up in Order to Grow. If you do make New Year's resolutions, resolving to read this book would not be a bad one at all. I'm going to read just a brief selection from a chapter in this course titled Shifting Images. It kind of reflects on Chuck's first wish as well. We start to feel a time of letting go of one thing and another. Our waistlines, our vigor, our 2020 vision, our trust in justice. We give up hoping to read all the books we once vowed to read, go to all the places we once vowed to visit. We even give up hoping that we'll succeed in being underweight or immortal. We feel shaken. We do not feel safe. Suddenly our friends, if not us, are having divorces, heart attacks, cancer. Some, even our own age, have died. As we acquire new aches and pains, our health care is of necessity, supplied by internists, cardiologists, dermatologists, podiatrists, urologists, gynecologists, and psychiatrists, from all of whom we want a second opinion. A second opinion that says, don't worry, you're going to live forever. Of course, no such opinion exists. Alluding to what I just said, I don't think it's actual immortality we want so much as the time we feel we need to see all of our hopes realized, to once and for all find our pearl. But realizing that we do not have that time is one of the necessary losses that Ms. Viorst identifies. And I think she's calling it a necessary loss because it then makes us focus on what we really do want and on who and what we really do want to be in this time-bound life that we have. So having disavowed New Year's resolutions for myself, I'm going to sum it up with a chutzpah to ask you to make one yourself. And here's what it is. Not exactly a resolution. I'd say make a personal wish or hope list for yourself. All the things you've ever wished or hoped for and that you're still doing so right now. And then get down that list and take a look at whatever hopes and expectations that are on that first list you're ready to relinquish. At whatever season of your life you may find yourselves. And you may find that quite liberating, for it may allow you to see what is truly worthy of your hopes and your desires and your energy in the years ahead. Number two on Reverend Gaines' list, quoting him now, I never asked to be God, but I expected to be able to control life so I'd never feel hurt, sad, or afraid. Well, it's not an irrational hope or expectation to want to live with a healthy level of self-respect and be at peace with yourself and your personal past. This is what I think he means by control. Having this does give you that necessary measure of control over your life that helps you and keeps you from being unduly manipulated or used. But the idea of being able to control our lives and life in general to the point of never being hurt or feeling pain or despair or sadness. That may not be the pearl you really want. Because the only way to get such a pearl as that would be to eliminate all the risk factors in your life. To never invest yourself in the lives of others, to never care, it would mean, in effect, ceasing to be human. A rock feels no pain, and an island never cries, as Paul Simon once reminded us. So control of life is a hope you want to see realized up to a point. But only up to a point. Because it is also a willingness to let go and be vulnerable to such things as hurt and fear and sadness and loss, which, ironically enough, are among those things that make genuine human relationships possible in the first place. Then there's Chuck's third hope. I expected peace on earth. In a world where hunger, poverty, racism, and ignorance would be eliminated. Here again, I think it's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek. We in the liberal tradition do have a way of hoping and expecting things to get better. John pointed out to us earlier, it was our universalist forebears at the forefront of all kinds of social improvement movements. We do hope things will get better, despite a temporary setback here and then. I think a hope that does need to be revisited over the seasons of our lives is one that concerns itself with the kind of world we will leave for those who come after. And to re-echo Judith Yorst here, perhaps another necessary loss is to drop the idea of ever living in a completely and wholly fair, sane, just, and loving world. And I don't mean this as a statement of despair, or of a loss of hope, or of a complete surrender to tragedy. I say it instead out of a recognition that we live in a world of human beings. Human beings with our brokenness as well as our wholeness, with our dreams and our fears, with our kindness and our cruelty, with our reverence for life and our disregard for life. For I know that as long as such a conglomerate of attributes resides in me, and I know they do, and if I may dare say, reside in each of us, then we're going to live in an imperfect world with our imperfect selves. And believe it or not, I mean that as a positive and hopeful statement. For I believe it is when we lose the expectation of hope or perfection for ourselves, for others, for our world at large, and we kind of cast it aside, then we are able to bring the best of who we are to both our personal relationships and our larger world with the best energy that we have. Something's lost and something's gained in living every day. That was Joni Mitchell who reminded us of that one. And a couple thousand years before Miss Mitchell, Jesus said something about the necessity of losing one's life in order to find it. I think that's the paradox we learn to live with as the seasons of our lives go by. We have to decide, we have to choose what it is we want and need to let go of, to lose, that is, in order to be about finding what we truly want and need, to find out what the nature of our pearl really and finally is. Part of continuing to grow throughout the whole life cycle is learning to live in the push and the pull of the joy and the exuberance and the excitement that life does offer and that many writers and poets have celebrated. It also means learning to live in the empty moments and the vacant places that we'll also encounter and which our writers and our poets also tell us about. And as we move through these seasons, with their joys and with their losses, with their times of grace and their moments of tragedy, I believe that having a community like this one, where we can bring those lives at whatever stage or condition they may be, I think that's crucial. So there is one resolution I will make, and I invite you to join me in it. And that is the resolution that we will continue to grow this wonderful liberal religious community and congregation that we have here. So that those who are now in our midst and those who will come into our midst in this upcoming year and the years after that will find a place where they can grow their lives as well, just as we have found it. Perhaps we can be the pearl that others seek and need. And so it is in this spirit that I have a singing resolution for us. It's the words to our closing hymn. It's number 1. May nothing evil cross this door.